coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's episode of The Curious Realm. I am currently at the Sistine Chapel Experience in Austin, running sound for not only the experience's opening night, but for a string quartet, all kinds of fun stuff. But as always, despite the fact of me being on the road or on site or anything like that, we always bring you new content, never repeat performances, never best of, anything like that. Our guest in the second segment tonight will be Anne Celine. We will be talking about Krampusnacht and other Christmas traditions, the importance of those traditions, as well as the importance of that didactic of good and bad that seems to come with so many holiday traditions. That'll be our conversation in the post-commercial break. In the first segment, we are happy to welcome back our good friend and author of the Humaniverse series, Keith Seeland. You can find his work at thehumaniverse.org. Excitedly, you can find his new book, The Humaniverse Guide, We Are Them, They Are Us, Our Ancestors, Us, and E.T. on Spotify. His first audio book is out. You can also find the hard copy of that at Amazon.com. You can find it at BarnesandNoble.com. Welcome back to the show, the indomitable Keith Seeland. Always great to have you on. How you doing, buddy?
Great, Chris. Hey, happy holidays to everybody wherever you are. This is 'tis the season.
Absolutely, man. We're into it. It is a great, fantastic part of the year. I love it because I can't stand heat. And living in Texas, it's like a very small window of the year where we get a reprieve. And it's even likely before Christmas that we will still see like 85, 90 degree days. But right now it's nice and crisp and cool out. It's like, it's perfect. It's great. And yes, I love these things. And once again, even referencing what we'll be talking about in the second part, these traditions that we have as humanity, these concepts that we have of good and evil and the source of these things and the source of us go back millennia sometimes. And the work that you have done, especially with petroglyphs around the world and their similarities and what these things mean and the messages behind them and how, once again, let's start where we always start with this, which is the idea of a petroglyph and how it is different than rock art, Keith.
Oh, okay. A petroglyph, there's various forms of the glyph series, so to speak. There's the petros, which are pecton. In other words, a stone, a tool of some kind will have been used to inscribe on the easel, which is usually a rock formation, usually an igneous rock type of a patina formation in that. Then there are, besides geoglyphs, there are pictographs, which are actually painted on. And the time frames in use for each of those two span many millennia, depending on the civilization from around the world. There are pictographs in existence from 75,000 years ago, and there are petroglyphs that are pecton from 30, 35, 40,000 years ago that we know of. And one very exciting thing about that is that in talking about archaeology, anthropology, our ancestors' heritages, things like that, what's most exciting is the many things that we have left to discover. And it's going to be that landscape will be going on for additional millennia. We've just begun to scrape the surface of who we are, who we were as an ancient people, and, you know, progressing into the future. So what's most exciting is that which is yet to be discovered. The third form of glyphs are what are called geoglyphs. And, well, as I see from behind me, I've kept my background screen here. This is an example, the astronaut waving hi from the Nazca lines in Peru. That's an example of a geoglyph in which the size of the symbolism is so big that an observer can only see and make sense of, or try to make sense of it from the air. We were, for this particular shot, almost 2,000 feet in the air as we flew over it. So those are the three main types of glyphs. But the glyph department is just one category of what I call symbolic representation. It's not rock art. It was and is a form of communication that the creators actually used to convey messages in many different contexts. They could have been telling stories about great food hunts in their lives, war stories of a sort. One of the good things about our ancestors, and in all of my talks and in all of my education, my platform here, my purpose for trying to help society understand who they are, is that, and hence it shows up in my titles, we are them, they are us. We are our ancestors, they are us. They thought, their minds operated and worked the same ways as ours do today. And I'm going back into Neolithic times from dozens of millennia ago. And when they wrote their symbolic representation, such as the glyphs and whatnot, and there are other forms of representation that I'll brief on in a minute, but these graphic symbolic representations, besides the war stories and whatnot, some of them would convey lighthearted moments, a day in the life of a particular tribe or family of people. Some of them were served as navigators, showing directions for passersby for locations of food and water, and in many cases, water especially, in that we're talking in indigenous geographies around the world, many of them, as is today, were in desert locales. So water was very important. So navigation routes were also very, very popular in these glyphs and symbolic representations. Also, they also scripted what they saw, many of their experiences, and amongst them, the most significant, and this is where I go into a deep detail about describing who our ancestors were and helping us understand ourselves through them, in that they considered as the most important thing in their lives the cardinal directions, and I'll throw the most general term out here, the great Please. Chain of life. Now, many researchers have a particular problem trying to describe all the various interplays between living lives as our Neolithic ancestors and their day-to-days and their very deep spiritual and cosmological connections. But my catch-all phrase concept is what I call the great chain of life. This phrase, this concept, incorporates all of the embodiment of what life was then, or what was back then, in with all of our ancestors. They were very, very much more holistic than we are today. And we can go off on that topic if we have time later on. But they were so connected. The great chain of life, inherent in its definition, connects all of the aspects of not only the human condition, but the condition of life on Earth. And they recognize that humans being at the most intelligent species, we were very important, but all the other life forms living on Earth, the animals, the plants, and the geography, the landscape, the ground that they walked on, the water that they swam in and drank from, the sky, the terrestrial world, the sky world, and the cosmological world, and those manifestations that came from that. These are all elements and aspects of the great chain of life. All of human beings, our species, condition, human natures, all of our moral codes, all of the operatives that instruct us how to live our lives come from this one concept, the great chain of life. So when anyone hears me talk, think of the great chain of life and the interconnectedness that our ancestors recognized with all of those functions of life, plants, animals, human beings, the ground, the sun, the moon, the stars, the Milky Way, heaven and hell, the ground below. All of those things work in total harmony, equilibrium, and balance with each other. And that's where the spiritualism of human beings was developed and evolved from our hominid ancestors from a million years ago. We became our brains, enabled us to become a more and more aware of our surroundings. Incidentally, I'm giving everybody a description of my new book title here also. So I write about all of these chapters, such as awareness, the mind, revolutions, when hunter-gatherers found favorable climatic conditions and ecological conditions to where they didn't have to be nomads to constantly hunt down animals and be on the hunt all the time.
Yeah.
They could settle down, become more sedentary. The end of the last current ice age and the younger driest periods enabled a beneficial modification to the Earth environment to where our hunter-gatherer ancestors could then decide to settle down, start communities, and start labor industries and build architecture and other things like that. Speaking of architecture, that's another form of what I call symbolic representation. Besides the glyphs and the linguistics that they may have had back then, they express themselves in many other forms of symbolic representation, and it shows up in the architecture that they used. It shows up in the developing awareness of their minds and the forms of shapes and patterns and cycles in nature. For example, the sun, which they recognized and worshiped as a god for many, many millennia.
Yep.
The sun, they visualized. We see the sun as a circular object. They saw the sun as a circular object. Circular geometry became sacred and worshipable for our ancestors. Witness that a lot of the early architectural representations were in circular form. It was only after the Neolithic times, when we more into the Holocene, and this is within the last 10,000 years or so, did humans decide to start incorporating the geometry of the square or the rectangle for such things as houses, communities, streets, so to speak, where they had neighbors lined up in an orderly row, windows, which is another very important sacred geometry, so to speak. So the human beings became aware as the millennia went on, and their minds further developed, and as their knowledge built, they continued, and it's a continual process today, where knowledge begets knowledge, knowledge is power, and through the evolutions of Mother Nature, so to speak, in creating more beneficial living conditions for human beings to not only survive, but thrive, and then not have to devote their 24/7 to obtaining food and water. They could then spend time in group activities, forming communities, forming labor industries, building architectures, building cultural centers of ritual and worship, and is helping creating more time in their days to develop appreciations for spiritual worship when their attention's turned to the sky.
Well,
as I consider the single most important aspect of human life for many, many, many millennia.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because like you're saying, that beginning with the circle, those are the two things that you see. It's the sun and the moon, and it's circles. And that's what rules your day and rules your night. It's what allows you to hunt and everything else. So, once you get to a point of a society where, and it's something that we talk about on the show regularly, especially whenever you're on, especially whenever Jared Murphy is on from RKOX, things like that. The idea that we as a society have lost that connection to the earth. You know, like even my grandfather didn't necessarily need a farmer's almanac to tell him when to put seed in the ground. He had generations of familial farming that told him when you see these things happening, you know, they followed once again for millennia. They followed the food. And through the seasons, and you had to know your location amongst the stars and know what the stars were in the sky to know when to hunt or when to fish or eventually when to plant. And yes, those same stars became what was worshipped, because the same way that hunting and gathering drove your society at the time, now it's the worship of the gods of that animal, or of the water, or of the sun that allows the crops to grow, because that without that God and without those crops, you're back to being struggling every single day. If it takes a fresh heart every 3 days from the temple top to keep that going, let's keep that going, because do you want to go back and be a hunter-gatherer again, or would you rather live in this opulence that we live in now? And we may not see that as opulence, but boy, howdy, at the time when you were just past the point of figuring out flint on flint makes spark makes fire, you know, that's a big point. And that is a huge cultural point of, yes, why we began worshiping in the way that we worship.
Yeah, and I go into great detail. Like I mentioned, I start. It's chronological development, but the early times in my earlier chapters, introduction and awareness, and that's just the human mind continuing to build on his knowledge base, and incorporating the perceptions, the cognition, and the thought process behind the connectedness. Here's a great example of what I mean by the great chain of life and the connectedness.
Please.
Take the example of how a tree grows. Without the sun, our ancestors they didn't have the chemical formula analysis of photosynthesis and carbon or whatever. Yeah. They didn't have that nuance or innuendo. They had the intuition that provided them to look at the universe, look at life with extreme intelligent holism and connectedness. They had the intuition to know that the sun created the trees along with water, created the trees would grow grow leaves, and then at the end of the season, at the end of the year, drop those leaves and go into another season. But therein lies a pattern and a cycle, because the next year, the whole process picked up again, and the tree grew more leaves, grew fruit, grew food, as with all other plants and whatnot. So the human mind, in its growing different regions, the neocortex especially, getting a little clinical. And I do that in my book, in my chapter, The Mind. I do get medical and clinical in the development of the human mind in the various regions that human beings use to interact with their environment and to develop what I call the attitudes and behaviors that underlie their physical activity throughout every day, throughout their entire lives, getting into the psychology of it and the cognitive, I call it cognitive utilization, the human mind. And I bring this up, history development from our hominids up to more Neolithic times and the Holocene. I describe the development of the human mind and its growing awareness and growing aptitude and intelligences in many different ways, like you mentioned, for creating better spear tips, better weapons, so to speak, hunting weapons and whatnot, to understand the cycles of animal migration, the day and night of the sun and the moon, and the changing of the seasons with the reading of the stars. All of those things as elements of the great chain of life. That is what a human being experiences throughout his entire life, every single day and night and whatever. So it was a grand masterful accumulation of human knowledge, and with some very big help from ecology and geology, for sure. You know, the physics that goes on with all of those, the seasons and the end of the ice age and all the events. Cosmological events that may have happened, the comets and asteroids and visits from other life forms and whatnot that helped shape the human condition and our human nature. So the connectedness of all those things, just remember the cycle of the sun and photosynthesis and growing plants and trees, and that our ancestors intuitively knew all of that stuff as part of the multi-cognitive thinking process. They didn't need the chemical formulas for that. They knew how life was created, and also too with witnessing the giving birth of their offspring and other animal life forms and whatnot, all part of the great chain of life.
Well, and, you know, that brings us to a great turning point in this conversation, Keith, which is not just our ancestors and us, but E.T. And, you know, going back to that concept that you were saying, like, I refer to the stars all the time. As you know, as many of my listeners know, I am an astrophotographer. Avidly watch the night sky. I love the night sky. It's one of the day that I first looked through a telescope and saw the rings of Saturn. I was hooked. I was addicted. I would never look at the night sky the same again. And I went to morning labs in high school for astronomy, all kinds of, like, showing up at a public park at like 4 a.m. meeting it. They would never allow you nowadays to go meet a teacher at a schoolyard at 4 a.m. All right.
How myopic are we? Yes.
That would never be able to happen again.
No.
But it was a special thing, and it was great. And it's one of those that, yes, when you're taught that sense of wonder and awe in that kind of way, it's beautiful. But to know that, once again, our ancestors looked up, they saw the same moon, they saw the stars in a slightly different position from where we're at now, just because of where we're at in the Milky Way, that kind of stuff. But if wherever you're living, folks, 10,000 years ago, people were looking at those same stars. It's not like the hemisphere has changed. So that connection, at what point, Keith, because, like, there are numerous religions of ancient cultures, numerous ancient culture origin stories begin in the stars and are from the stars, saying that we are from the stars. Everything from the Dogon tribe to literally the Aborigines of Australia, to the Native Americans, to Mayan, to like
Sumeria,
it's the whole
Egypt.
World. It's the whole world over. So
yep.
It's not
Hindu,
like, and
Chinese.
Granted, there is the wild fact that yes, residue from coca and coca leaves was found in mummies in Egypt. Pretty fascinating stuff. So that means that there may have been a trade route. There may have been knowledge in Africa of South America, because there's only one place in the world that coca leaves grow, and it definitely ain't in Africa or in Egypt, you know.
That we've found yet.
Yeah.
And one part of my overview when I have conversations about this, one of the very most important things about studying ancient anthropology and archaeology in history, it is most primarily important for you to immerse yourself as best you can in the time of who you're studying, whether that be, let's say, ancient Egypt from 7,000 years ago. That's an example of a point where ecology and geology could be saying something different, especially if we make discoveries of those things. You brought up the cocoa plant. Now, I'm not saying that the cocoa has been discovered in other places, but my example is Egypt, 7,000 years ago, the Sahara Desert was not a desert. It was a temperate
Sure.
zone that flourished in animal life. There's potential there that we may find examples of indigenous plants indigenous to that particular area, which then may discount the theory of the ability of indigenous to travel great distances to see each other. I'm not trying to be the debunker here or anything My point is that immerse yourself in their time to get the best understanding of who they were, why they made their glyphs and their symbolic representations the way they did, why they conducted their lives the way they did. Which is a lot different, and that's a bias that every human being has today, even all the trained scientists.
Absolutely. And that's just it. Once again, it is our advancedness with growing food, things like that, that gives us the luxury and the time that we have to follow the endeavors and make technology and do the. And other than that, we'd be busy out plowing fields still every single day by hand to make that happen and to feed our population, you know? So the idea of, once again, that connectedness throughout history, and the idea that we have come from the stars and that we are of the stars. How through your studies and through your research, how have you found, I guess, the source of that connection? Have you found some way that, or some turning point at which societies began to look and consider that?
I bring up a couple of the thematic points in my new book writing here, the psychology of the human being's attitude and behavior, and the structure of our brain, and the history that a development that our mind went through to create different intelligences, so to speak, that would help us in dealing with the environment, aka surviving, living our lives, obtaining more knowledge, and then with the help of sometimes other ecological or geophysical changes in our planet, so to speak, the home that we call Earth, those changes would help manufacture easier ways to live. creating more time in our 24/7 day to then devote to other things. On that point, the human mind of, let's say we found the earliest examples from about 125,000 years ago. And I'm including with humans, I'm including our ancestral kin, Neanderthals. Mm. And I'm bringing up the point of the human mind creating the concept of the soul. That concept, to me, indicates that human beings, that was, I believe, the genesis of religiosity, or eventually a formal religion. From findings in Georgia and other in the Eurasian continent, Neanderthals were found to have ceremonial and emotional grave tombs, so to speak. Yeah. We've found many examples to where the Neanderthal buried their dead with grave goods around them in an emotional, some were found with flower petals and buds, grave goods, accoutrements that they used throughout their lives. The human mind, in their attitude and behavior development back at that time, created a process of remembering, so to speak. And what I call, and what's been called by other researchers, a specialized or a generalized form of intelligence. Donald Mithen, a longtime archaeologist, created different chapels of the human mind that included human ways of thinking that were specialized intelligences. In other words, the mind being used to create new weapons, new spear tips, better spear tips, longer lasting spear tips, whatnot. Yeah. But then as the human beings developed from hominids into the Neanderthal stage, and Denisovans and other kindred species back at that time, and humans, Homo sapien, created in their minds, they created a generalized intelligence, which helped the Homo sapien to eventually become the human being survivor in the competition between competing species over life, longevity, and whatnot. Homo sapien developed the generalized intelligence to where we could then think and apply more different types of cognitions, such as emotional attachment to family members. I mean, even our Neanderthals, when they gave birth, they witnessed it.
Yeah,
there is a deep-seated basal brain emotional attachment to that process. They saw it in nature with animals, and in plants, they understood the recurring nature of the regrowth of plants and food, things like that. So the mind, not only of Homo sapien, but of Neanderthals, developed to the point where their minds then became aware that their siblings and their ancestors, their elders, didn't live forever. They expired.
Yeah.
They died. They had to bury them. This was a creation of the minds of our ancestors to help the mind remember and create these generalized intelligences, to remember our ancestors.
Yeah.
And by evolution and the more availability of, again, creating more time in the 24/7 day physically for us to put our minds to other uses, we could then look to and address the issues of the gods, the deities, those potential ETs. And you mentioned the creator gods, the Ama with the Dogon and the Egyptians and Enlil and Enki, and going on all through the Aborigines, the Wanji, That's a tough name for me to remember. The one genus, I'm sorry. But all of our universals, that was a universal, one of many, many, many universal traits of Homo sapiens and sapiens sapiens is the ways that we thought and how we worship the gods and deities. But the creation of religion came from, in my mind, the development of the concept of the soul and the mindful attributions towards creating memories, mnemonics, over remembering our ancestors and our descendants, and then having the time to start having a relationship with the gods, the deities, and those ETs from above in the sky world that interacted with us. Religion eventually developed from that. And what I mean, it wasn't a 2-year type of a thing. It was many thousands of years. But that's how we're building on our knowledge today, is the same process as our ancestors. We build more and we just keep going on and on and on and on. So I believe religion came from that concept of the soul and from their mindful attributions to and their emotional attributions to wanting to have relationship with their ancestors, their elders, and their descendants as passed on through generations and evolved into Neolithics and our Holocene today. So religion wasn't a snap judgment type of a creation type of a thing, but all the creation of the human mind. Well, and as we get on through here in our conversation, I'll give you some more good details on what the human mind created when we came together from hunter-gatherers into developing what I call urbanization. And many researchers call it the agricultural revolution, where humans came together and started planting. I call it, and that's another one of my chapters, the revolutions, but we had many of them. The most important wasn't the agriculture, because we already had that. It was the revolution of the mind that created urban communities, and by carrying along our psychology of attitudes and behaviors and what I call multitasking cognitive utilization, we developed labor industries, group psychology, socialization, and levels of power, control, and competition.
And I was just about to say, especially with Neanderthals beginning to bury, Homo sapien beginning to bury, things like that, with that concept of mortality, with the beginning of soul and that coming into religion, at what point did we begin, did structure as we know it, because of course the first things other than shelter to keep warm that would be built would be temple. Did we begin with monument to the dead, or with temple when it came to beginning that concept of putting structure in for society?
We observe this again through powers of observation. And when I say our ancestors, I'm including Neanderthals and the kindred temporal species that lived back then. What they observed in nature, they observed animals, mothers and their newborn young in their behaviors, the mothers and in some species, the fathers caring for their young, in human beings caring for the young. These things just rubbed off into our cognitive utilizations, and they're so part of our instinctive behavior. This is a neurological, the basal brain, which is the core essence of any life form's brain. Now human beings have many more dimensions to it. A lot of animals do have many more dimensions also, but the instinctual brain center is our basal brain connections. And all animals have that, the instinct fight or flight to collect food, the need for food to actually live. Think of it as Abraham Maslow's pyramid. The most basic part of his pyramid was the survival, food, water, and oxygen. Then as the humans, the intelligences developed to where we could then spend more of our 24/7 into other pursuits such as the emotions, our limbic system, which is one of the peripheral structural brain systems. And a lot of animals, even today, we don't, and that's part of our problem, we don't recognize that our animal species, a lot of them exhibit these fantastically excellent, for lack of a better word, characteristics and traits that we can learn a lot from our animals. But they all had them back then, raising your young, getting them out on their own for them to live their lives and procreate and perpetuate the species. They all had that. So eventually it was the brain. And that's where I say that it's the thought revolution that was the most important revolution that created the boundary from hunter-gatherer to Neolithic Holocene.
Yeah.
Because I'm kind of combining those two together. And there's a revolution in what the definition of Neolithic man is. And that's playing out right now. And to where we're going to be one big, we're recognizing that our ancestors from the Tepes, from ancient Anatolia, from 15, 20,000 years ago, and our Neolithic ancestors, they were a lot more intelligent. And that's part of my point than we're giving them credit for. And that's part of my purpose is to trying to help us learn from our ancestors, learn where we came from, and learn that it was not just a one-off process of where the light bulb was turned on, we developed religion. It was a gradual process, to answer your question in a long-winded way.
That's okay.
It was simple monuments or simple representations, symbolic representations, forms of communication in those burials, in those tombs, in the mounds that were first the concept of the grave. The first ones were mounds that Neolithic developed. Then eventually it became to where we had stones placed above them, where the human mind or the Neanderthal mind could go back and visit in their mindful representation, visit their ancestors. If they had a problem with a hunt or in a particular attitude and behavior in their psychological mind, they could sometimes draw on the memories of their ancestors for guidance. And in some very important ways that we're just starting to learn, developing a transcendental or a transdimensional connection with our ancestors. In other words, like what we would do today or what shamans did back in our Neolithic times to try and relieve fear, stress, and tension from the subject of the patient. The shamans were created by the leaders as a power and control mechanism to be in contact transdimensionally with the gods in the sky to help relieve, whether it's an individual in the community or whether it's the community at large, to relieve fear, stress, and tension in their psychological lives.
Yeah.
So it was a process.
And you know, like you said, the none of this came about rapidly. This was thousands and thousands of years of evolution of thought and form of thought. And even with that taken into account, the idea that, once again, none of that can happen to that extent while you are roaming the countryside and setting up camp every night.
Absolutely.
And tearing it down in the morning. But That's a third of your day right there, almost just doing that activity or finding water, things like that. There were things that they had to worry about that we don't have to worry about necessarily. There are still parts of the world that have to worry about finding clean potable water every single day, you know. But if you are living in a civilized country, that's not the case. You know, these things that were a great struggle for humanity for millennia are taken care of by technology because we had the time to stop and think about how to do it.
And since the times that what I call the revolutions of agriculture and most importantly of thought and of urbanization, I think even at that point we were blessed, our species was blessed with a most fantastic geophysical evolutionary process. But remember too, our ancestors from back then still didn't have the knowledge that we do today. In other words, where they had developed a religiosity, so to speak, now they had more time in their 24/7 to create, again, labor industries, create inventories of food, and then to then have the time to build structures to create communities and to help address those psychological fears that every human being even today has of daily fear, stress, and tension.
Yeah.
Now in a social community setting where that we've got not only an individual psychology and butting heads against an egalitarian politics, so to speak, where it was one for all for one with our hunter-gatherers. Now we had to develop a social concept of leadership.
Yep.
And from that, group psychology then created the problems of power, control, and competition. And those are two other chapters that I address in my book, along with the budding symbolism, so to speak, and the representations that were opened up. Now, remember that the glyphs, the pictographs and the petroglyphs, we found examples from 100,000 years ago, Blombos Cave in South Africa, Caceres in Spain, and all throughout the world. We had those for 100,000 years. So the human mind was aware back then of their mind was aware of their environment, of them. You know, we had imprints, handprints, and nothing else. And in the earliest ones that we found so far, no animal scenes or anything like that, but handprints, meaning identity. I, the creator of this glyph, am a person. I identified with it. Here's my handprint. Eventually, they created scenes with geometric figures. Again, the sacred geometry of the circle, the square, the trapezoid, and the pyramid, the triangle, so to speak, and which then, again, not in a one-off, but throughout evolution, then developed into scenes where animals were depicted. Now they projected their mind through their eyes and their senses into their environment around them. Then animals became important, the environment, the physical environment around them, all as part of the process leading up to and including a religiosity to where then they always saw the night sky, but through eons of observation and patterns and cycles in the geophysics of planet Earth and living on the planets, change of seasons, ice ages, things like that, all the human intelligence developed in their mind, their cognitive utilizations to develop all of these things to the point in the Neolithic times at the end of the last ice age. That was probably the most beneficial geophysical process that humans have gone through, even including up to today, that changed our lives for the better. And again, created the urbanization and the new psychologies of the upper levels of Maslow's pyramid, the socialization, the love, the self-actualization, so to speak, and those things. But the new problems of social psychology and having to deal with the same psychological, mindful stresses, fears, and tensions of living life as a human being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a new issue.
And it's an all new existential crisis in a modern day and age, because once again, these are things that, and this was explained to me by literally an anxiety and panic doctor that I had for a little while. The fact of, like, make no mistake, these physiological responses that you are having to stress, to the world around you, things like that, Chris, those are preternatural responses to panic that have been wired into us since we were afraid of the dark and slept on our belly instead of our back because it was safer. Yep. You know, things like that. He's like, these are things that are tied into you for a reason, because they are connecting you to the world around you. So you need to learn to recognize them and heed them and pay attention to them. It's not a bad thing that they're happening. You just need to learn to recognize that they're happening for a reason, you know, and we've lost track of that as humanity. We've lost track of what this feeling is for. Because once again, it's for something totally different. It's for a mechanism of survival that we have lost track of. So even the idea of our want of connection with something greater than us, and let's use the last, we've got about 10 minutes left here, Keith. In that last 10 minutes, let's talk about that connection to the stars, that connection to beyond.
Yeah.
And that full circle part of the conversation, going back to how this all comes from our understanding that we have a soul, that we're something different than just this corporeal being, and that we're tied to something greater than us. How do we get back to that point of connection? Because as we've talked about in numerous episodes with you, your whole work with the Humaniverse is, when will we as humanity be ready for them to have a conversation with us? And when will they see us as ready and worthy? You know, did we have that conversation in the past, and are we now unworthy? And how do we get back to that?
Yeah, our knowledge has caused us to create these new devices of technology. I cover this in the book also. Our knowledge has caused us to create the new instrumentations. But in that same way, we've turned down a path of myopia, or to use a generational term, sure, a rabbit hole, so to speak, a species related rabbit hole, to where we're still losing more and more awareness. We have the awareness of connectedness, or what I call the great chain of life.
Sure.
Our ancestors were not burdened with our devices of technology. And I'm not proposing that we do away with all our technology, although if you talk to a lot of experiencers from E.T. Events, that the ET will give them the message that human beings, your runaway technology, you don't know how to use it. That's why you're not ready,
yep,
for us ET to come down to you. So, relating that to the connections and the great chain of being, the holism, the equilibrium, and the synchronicity, and the recognition that our ancestors had. I'll give you a great lesson here. This is in another couple of chapters of my book here. I'll go back to Göbekli Tepe. I've spent a lot of time there over the past few years. And I'm going to give you a little bit of discovery in the pillar setups and what it meant in the archaeoastronomy aspects of living life at Göbekli Tepe and all the interconnections of everything. Specifically, I get into a discussion about, looking at the night sky and how their buildings, how their architecture was constructed, the contexts that all of these central pillars reside within, all of the petroglyphs, the inscriptions, and all of the artifacts that were left there from a world that existed roughly 13,000 or even more years ago. And there's hundreds of tepes that exist in ancient Anatolia. But Göbekli, there's a particular example there, Pillar 43, which has depictions of various animals and then what look like three handbags, or researchers and everybody today are calling them purses and whatnot. This is an example of their, I think, a combination of their religiosity, their appeals to the gods and the deities and the ETs for help in relieving fear, stress, and tension, and the budding problems that came with competition and group psychology, group behavior, power and control, things like that. Now, we know that they didn't have those instruments that we know today as far as in the night sky. They thought that the stars were writing from the gods. Yeah. You know, they didn't know any better. We know somewhat better today anyway. So they appealed to their gods for basically everything. So the Pillar 43 is an example to me, and all the researchers think of it. Göbekli Tepe is a ceremonial temple, ritual temple. Yes, it is. I agree with that. But it was also a community, in that 95% of Göbekli Tepe hasn't even been uncovered yet. When it's all uncovered, GT is going to be a community with a ritual central temple for ceremonial worship of their gods and of their ancestors. Those pillars and the central pillars, a lot of them, were to me the first human totem poles, so to speak. You know, Native America and their wooden totem poles and whatnot. So this concept existed with the pillars at Göbekli Tepe. Now, specifically in Pillar 43 and the purpose that these buildings were built, there's a whole series of them, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, and there's going to be 25 more of them as we go through. They're synchronized. The central pillars are altars, and they're synchronized geocompass with positions in the night sky. And as a building was used for a period of a couple of hundred years, the new building was built with a different geocompass reading coordinate. The previous building was buried. Building D is the oldest. That lasted for about 200-300 years. It was buried. Building C became, but the geocompass readings were different. The central altar pointed to, for building D, the oldest one, pointed to the North Star. The North Star at that time, roughly 12,000 years ago, was a star in Hercules called Iota Hercules. In the night sky, all the stars moved. Hence, our ancestors developed the concept of writing of the gods, because all of those moving stars were messages that the gods and the visits from ET, going back to the Egyptians, the Sumerians, and the Dogon, and all the Aborigines and that, they all universally maintain the same thought cognitive utilization processes as another universal. So the North Star was the one star that didn't move. Iota Hercules back at that time. So for a couple of hundred years, Iota Hercules stayed at the compass visual observation point looking at the North Star, but eventually it moved to the west. They then found that building D no longer had a use in that way. They buried it. They built building C with a new compass coordinate, which would keep in line with Hercules, the square trapezoidal sacred geometry of Hercules. That constellation, along with a lot of the glyphs, also have. I'll get to the animals in a second, but the glyphs, sure. Quite a few of them have inscriptions which look like the letter H, and then some of them have inscriptions which look like the letter I and C. H, when we look in the sky, is representation of Hercules. C could be a representation of Corona Borealis. I can be a representation of Hercules turned sideways, which, you know, as an astrophotographer, can happen in the course of one evening, and especially throughout different times of the year, as procession of the equinoxes moved around, and Iota Hercules begot, well, Vega was before Iota Hercules and then moved into Draco and now to Polaris. But so their attributions to God worship and spirituality and instructions and everything from the gods. I maintain that because Hercules and Corona Borealis lie alongside the Milky Way, the Great Rift, and the button hook that is the Milky Way and the Great Rift itself, that Hercules, in my mind, to them, was a path of the souls of the departed. Now you bring in a lot of the other pillars, which are totem poles in mindful remembrances of their ancestors and their lives' attributions, and you bring in the animals such as the vulture, which, according to human observation, we see vultures flying around dead or soon to be dead bodies. The vulture then became a navigator, transporting the soul of the dead to heaven.
And
our ancestors, heaven and hell, in a lot of the cultures, was the Milky Way and the Great Rift. So for me, for the Anatolians, unidentified races of the Tepes of ancient Turkey, Hercules and Corona Borealis, along with Cygnus and a couple other constellations, were very extremely important. But Hercules, to me, was their pathway to the path of a soul to heaven.
Wow.
And eternity. And you see examples of, in other cultures, the trapezoidal shape of the Hercules, the keystone, which is what the Hercules core is called. South America, the ancient Andean cultures, just go through when I was there months ago, all of the trapezoidal windows that were built, Aliente Tambo, you name the site, and they all have this sacred geometry representation. You see it in ancient Egypt. You see it over in the Far East in ancient Hindu and Chinese archaeology, symbolic representation. Now, I also recognize that they were also, and this is another attribute where our ancestors were extremely intelligent. The trapezoidal window was also practical in that they, in South America, it's in the Andes, the geology is very prone to the world's worst earthquakes. Mm. That structure of architecture is far more worthy of sustaining massive earthquake destruction than square windows are. Our ancestors use their intelligent minds and their cognition, their utilizations to know that and build accordingly around that.
Yeah, and I mean,
so that's just a little side point.
That's why Roman architecture includes the keystone in the middle of arches, because that's the point of pressure equilaterally on both sides that supplies the support and makes it one of the strongest structures that you can make. So, Keith, I love our conversations, man. It is always awesome to talk with you about your research. You have such an in-depth knowledge of this stuff, and it's great to hear that your new book is out. I'm so excited. But before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to, A, find all of your books and keep up with everything that is Keith Seeland, where they can go to find the new Humaniverse guide, Humaniverse, We Are Them, They Are Us, Our Ancestors, Us and ET, as well as the new audiobook version of it. So please go ahead.
Yeah. All four titles are in print and available through Amazon, and the new title, also current one, is through any of the distribution parts of the Ingram network. So you're talking Barnes and Noble, Apple. Great. And Amazon, and all of the other. You can look up at my website. I don't think I've got the new title up on the website yet, but the other three books are up there. And also through all the classical retail booksellers. The ebook is available through what was it called? I don't think it's available on Amazon, but it's all of the audiobook, or not the audiobook, the ebook networks. Draft to Digital. If you just look up Draft to Digital, they'll list all of their all of their retail distributors, and this is all worldwide, so to speak. You can get them. So if you're not listening and you're not in the U.S., go to your local Amazon or Draft to Digital, the Ingram Network. And the audiobook especially is available through the Spotify network and Voices by InAudio and all of their distributors nationwide in the U.S. and various countries throughout the world. The audiobook, I'll give you a little, if this is interesting for you, the audiobook is a little special because it's my voice, but it is an artificial intelligence, a digital narrated narration creation of my voice. But you'll hear my voice, but I'm narrating it, but it's with the help of digital technology. So that's why that platform's so new that a lot of countries have not come aboard with the legalities to be able to release it yet. So I think it's available only within the US, I believe the UK, I believe Australia, and I don't think Canada has it yet, but if you're in Canada, you can get it in the U.S. But any of those popular book platforms or through the website, or I could even give you, if you want to email me, I can give you my email, and you can, if you want to request a copy of the book, and I'll be happy to accommodate you.
Awesome. Keith, once again, it's always great talking with you, man. I love our conversations. It's great stuff. I can't wait to get my copy. It's already in the mail. So I'm looking forward to reading it. Take care of yourself, and hold the line real quick while we close things out with this segment with the audience.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for having me, Chris. Happy holidays, everybody.
Always a pleasure, man. Truly. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Keith Seelan and the Humaniverse Guide, especially the new version, the Humaniverse Guide, We Are Them, They Are Us, Our Ancestors, Us and ET. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Anne Celine. We will be talking about more modern traditions when it comes to religion, when it comes to the holiday season. We're going to start off with Krampus, and we're going to go from there, and the way that good and evil drives us as humanity and brings us to these points of pivot and change. We'll be getting into that and so much more right after this with Anne Celine, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying around through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by True Hemp Science today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process by which every part of the hemp plant is used, from seeds and stems to leaves, flowers, roots. Every part of the plant is used, combusted, reused, and that process followed again and again until nothing remains but an amazing spigeric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. It has done me wonders over the last many years, and I hope it does for you as well. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today, folks. Use the code CURIOUS7. You will get 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, as well as two free edibles. Our guest in this segment is our good friend, Ann Celine. We will be talking about traditions. We're going to start off with like Krampus and stuff like that, but we're going to be going into holiday traditions and the roots of these things, where they come from, stuff like that. And I start with Krampus because, well, I'm a big fan of Krampus. This is a wood burning that a friend of mine made me many years ago. Thank you, Billy Stewart, and Scary Dad for that. But I remember when I first heard about Krampus, it was when I was in my Rome semester in 93, and seeing things like that on the walls in like Prague, that kind of stuff, and being like, wow, what is this? What is this all about? And going at the time, I had a Russian friend. We had a lot of Russian people on our campus and had heard about Black Peter and the whole concept of this anti-Klaus that exists in the world, and that the true yang to the yin that is Santa Claus, the idea of gifting and being kind of heart and everything else, not so much with these. So welcome back to the show, Anne. How have you been?
Thank you so much for having me. I love being here with you all. I've been great, just working hard on my books and, you know, getting ready for the holiday season.
Absolutely. And new candles, all kinds of stuff. I saw you had a whole crop of candles going out. So congrats
on
that.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's been amazing. It's been fun to dip my toes into candle making and the different, you know, scents and the fragrances. You know, it's just, it's amazing. And even kind of going into more of the like a ritual candle. So some of them are, you know, book companion. So it really brings what you read to life. And then the others are more ritual based. So it's been a fun adventure.
That is fantastic. And I do a lot of things like that. It's one of those, you're putting intent into things when you care for things like that. So good on you for carrying on such traditions, because that is a lot of people don't realize that is quite literally the root of witchcraft. So many different things.
Yes.
The idea of doing things to put energy into the world as you do them. It's why home cooked food tastes better than restaurant cooked food most of the time.
Exactly.
But you find a good chef with that same love in his heart that a mom has for her kids while she's making food, and you get the same thing. It's pretty fascinating. So,
Yeah. I agree with that. It's, you know, I have one rule in my kitchen, and that is no fighting. No fighting in the kitchen. you know, the kids can be running around and everything, but, you know, any kind of screaming, yelling, fighting, whatever it is, I don't want it in my kitchen. I really truly believe that the energy that we put in there, and especially when we're cooking, when we're stirring different things, it really bakes it in to that piece. And I've had, you know, it's one of those things where I can make myself coffee or a grilled cheese sandwich, but then I ask my partner, hey, can you make this for me? And he may make it the exact same way, but it tastes different. And that difference is the act of service, the act of love, and that energy that was put into it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, you may think this is divergent, folks. It's not, because it leads directly into what we're talking about, which is that source of tradition and where these things come from. And a lot of our holiday traditions come from the exact same concept. They come from the exact same idea of giving gratitude for what you have and what you have received, and also giving back for what you have received. The prime example for that I always taught, I always taught a lot of pagan source tradition whenever I taught CCE, especially around the time of All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day, around the time of Christmas, and around the time of Easter. These are celebrations that we as Christians, as we spread the word, things like that, kind of usurped as we went along, and brought these things in and would be like, oh, hey, Cult of Mithra. Interesting. Yeah, well, we have something like that. You should check it out. And we kind of absorbed those as things went on, and made a marriage between them. So the example I would always give was offerings to the Yule tree, which is where we get the whole idea of decorating the Christmas tree, and especially the idea of tinsel. That was usually like the entrails of your kill. you know, it was like the first kill of the hunting season, and you would wrap it around an evergreen tree, the one tree that didn't die during the winter, in prayer to Gaia that what you've just provided me, please keep providing. And that's where tinsel came from. You know, it's fascinating when you start digging into those things.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I have a lot of friends that love to, you know, they don't necessarily celebrate Christmas itself, but they will celebrate like Yule, and they will go outside and they will decorate the trees for the wildlife. So they may put out, you know, the nuts and the berries and hang the different things from the trees. And it's amazing, especially some of the pictures that they've sent where you can see deer or squirrel or whatever, you know. And it's like I learned from one of them that it's like 1,000 nuts to be able to have a squirrel survive through winter, but the winter locks in what they've buried, so they're unable to access those. And so then on Yule, they're giving back, and it's that symbiosis. I think it's a beautiful tradition. And so for me, with my tree that I have inside, it's a fake tree, but I also have fake candles because, you know, my grandfather, he grew up with having candles on his tree. You know, he was born in 1930, and so it's kind of, you know, the old traditions. And then of course I have a lot more of the natural ornaments on it. So pine cones and, you know, the dried oranges and, you know, some ribbons and things like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and even the things that you would traditionally get in your stocking that was hung by the chimney with care, things like that. That was snacks and treats, that kind of stuff. It became toys and everything else. But when you look at the original stories of St. Nicholas and coming around and putting gold coins under people's shoes and that kind of stuff.
Using the old socks and hanging them by the fire. My grandmother, she would get like, they would make popcorn balls.
Yep.
And that's what they would give. And then also a fresh orange as well. And, you know, my grandfather loved that. So, of course, growing up, I always had a fresh orange in my stocking. So.
Well, and you know, that brings us to this idea of Santa Claus and Father Christmas and the others that come along with him, because, you know, it's hard, especially with any religion. And it's hard if you don't have the didactic, if you don't have the direct opposite almost, then what is the motivation? Can good exist without evil? That old philosophic question, you know, or even the idea of, in seminary, it was something that we postulated all the time and would sit around and just openly debate, the idea of, is evil necessary? Just for the whole concept of free will, is evil necessary? You know, do you have to have the option for a choice of evil for free will to exist, and not just be controlled by the greater, you know?
Well, exactly. And, you know, you were mentioning Krampus, and he has a special place in my history because, so my family come from a place that was known as Bessarabia. So right now that would be like Moldova area over, you know, Ukraine, Moldova.
Sure.
And so we came from there. We were known as the Germans from the Black Sea, so the Black Sea Germans. And so with that, I also, you know, I got to grow up with all kinds of amazing, like the food, the traditions. And of course, my grandparents and my father being into ephemera, so old postcards, photographs, and what have you.
Sure.
I remember growing up and I would be looking through their cards, the postcards. And of course, my grandma's favorite, she had a whole photo album where she saved really special Santa cards. One Santa postcard can go anywhere between $500 and $900. These things are incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so I remember seeing Krampus. Because my dad had his own Krampus section in this box. And then, of course, the nicer ones were in that, you know, folder. And I remember being like, who is this? And I remember my father telling me, well, this is Krampus. And this is what he does. You know, he beats bad children. He comes before Santa. And if you've been bad, then he will take you in the night. And it was scary. It was really scary. And I was just like, oh my gosh. So I actually grew up fearing Krampus and knowing of him since I was just a wee thing. And so it was so funny because I got into this community, you know, back in 2015, and I was having the caravan and KPNL. And I remember everybody felt, you know, that depression once Halloween was over. And I was like, but wait, there's so much with Christmas. I mean, there's, you know, the ghost storytelling and there's all these monsters and there's Krampus. And it took a couple years. He wasn't the star that he is now in our community.
Yeah.
I would say that it wasn't until like 2018 or 2019, maybe 2018-ish. And then he really started coming out and people started talking about him. And Sam Sheeran has an incredible, he's got like a coloring book that he's made that has different Krampus, you know, pages that you can color. Definitely great art to go check out. And so, yeah, so that was a really cool addition to see come into our community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even bringing that point around to it and the idea, because we've had the conversation, not just with you, but with King Gerhard, mm-hmm. with Lyle Blackburn, all kinds of things. The idea of cryptids and other legends where these creatures are either a protectorate spirit or an avenging spirit, one of the two.
Right.
And specifically when it comes to the Goatman, I was just recently watching the Goatman documentary that just came out.
Nice.
That features both Ken and Lyle. And that's part of it. That's part of what they're talking about is the fact that like a lot of these things, a lot of the sightings specifically of Goatman, things like that are like Lover's Lane stories. So they're coming from places where people are doing something verboten, something forbidden to society, that kind of stuff, where they're going specifically out of public view to go do their naughty thing. And you know, that's when, well, let's describe it exactly. Let's see. In the tradition rooted in pagan winter, let's see. Yeah, he beats children with sticks. He throws chains around them, either puts them in a sack or in a basket and takes them off to hell. Never mind the logical fallacy of the fact that if Krampus comes along and takes you away, then it really doesn't matter if Santa knows if you're good or bad. Like 0%, you're gone. You are not in the equation for Santa to even care about whether to stop at your house, dude. So at what point did that logical part click for you growing up with Krampus?
Right. Well,
did it come before or after the realization of Santa? And
you know, it's one of those things where I actually never really contemplated that, but I did realize that I had two of my stories mixed up because I had thought that Krampus was going to drag me off if I was bad and put me in a stew and eat me. Mm. But that's actually Gryla. That's Gryla and the Yule Lads. That's Icelandic. She's like an ogress. And so that's what she does with, I think it's bad children. I never contemplated that. It was just be good. That was the only choice. That was it. And so it was a fascinating way to grow up, and then being able to learn about all the other monsters that exist within the, you know, this winter time. And, Gryla and the Yule Lads was always something really interesting to me as well. That was my next that I had learned about. And one time I had this, because I always like rewriting The Night Before Christmas.
Okay.
And so I had rewritten one about Gryla and the Yule Lads coming and taking you and laughing, and you hear it in the distance and you hear Krampus's chains in the snow. So I love this time of year. I really do.
Well, it's interesting because I love this time of year as well, mainly due to traditions. So like that. Yeah. Even I was just saying last week how Thanksgiving is just with a friend of mine, Jer, who you happen to know.
Oh, yeah.
That literally Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. And it's because there are no presuppositions. There are no disappointments. There are no like, I didn't get what I was looking for. Yes. Somebody didn't think about this. Or it's mm-hmm. literally just the idea of let's just get together and share a meal.
Yes. Yes, and that's beautiful.
We don't have to get into religious presuppositions. We don't have to get into anything like that. Let's just all get together and communally share a meal.
Sharing gratitude and everything. Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And there's a reason why at least in the Catholic calendar and other Christian calendars, the Advent season begins directly after that. You know, it's don't get me wrong. The Advent season's been around since like the Middle Ages, folks. So it's not has nothing at all to do with actual Thanksgiving. It just happens to be that's the beginning of it, you know, like that. And it's interesting that that's when people choose to because, you know, it was one of those even talking with my wife, Amy. I was like, no, we'll wait till after Thanksgiving to put the tree up.
Right.
She tried watching a Christmas movie and I was like, yeah, that's not happening. there is a whole nother holiday inside of here that I know may seem like it's like wedged in there because as mm-hmm. soon as Halloween is almost off the shelf, Santa's chilling next to him.
Yeah. You know? No, that's true. And that, you know, I did a research project once on Santa in regards to the commercialized, and it was, I believe, so
it was Coca-Cola.
A lot of people don't know. Yes, it was Coca-Cola, but a lot of people don't know that his suits were actually brown and blue. I saw him in green, like on the old postcards.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was Coca-Cola that turned him into the red wearing Santa that he is today.
Yeah.
And then Hallmark came in as well. And then it was just, you know, it was a huge money grab. And so it's hard because now, because of the money and the Black Friday and all that kind of stuff, the holidays are coming out way too soon. And then they're getting, you know, pushed out by the other holidays that are coming. And so for me, I wait until the day after Thanksgiving before I do anything or think of anything Christmas at all. And also the reason for that is because if you look traditionally at the dinners, you have like one big meat, whatever it is. Maybe it's a turkey, maybe it's a ham. And then the side dishes can be very similar. At least they were for me growing up. So you have the stuffing, the deviled eggs, the potatoes, whether, you know, you might have the yams versus the regular potatoes, whatever.
Sure.
And so, if you have the Christmas decorations up during Thanksgiving, it kind of feels like you already did Christmas by the time Christmas comes. And I want it to be its own, you know, its very own thing.
Yeah. No, and that's just it. It's one of those, I want Thanksgiving to stand out on its own. Like these, if we're going to go holiday season about it, then let's make it that, you know. but yeah, for me, truly, it's the fact of you've got to separate them in that kind of way.
Yeah.
and have that kind of distance so that you can get into that mode. And even once again, the idea, because this is being recorded shortly after Krampusnacht. Right. Krampus, once again, does not come on Christmas night. It comes, right. He comes on December 5th. So yep. He comes almost as smooth. He's got like a month of reaping almost. Yep. Before Santa gets one night, like Krampus, and that'll, you know, even working the Sistine Chapel experience that I'm working yeah. right now, one of the things that they point out is in the Last Judgment, there's the small Book of Life that Michelangelo paints and the very large and thick Book of the Damned.
Right.
Even Michelangelo's like, yeah, your chances of getting out of here are very small.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, when you look at the fact of Krampus has like 25 times more than Santa does to yep. do. But the idea oh, of yeah. that, and the idea that there is an avenging spirit, that there is something else that is making sure that you are a good boy and girl and keeping you in line. Right. And yeah, you know, you kind of have to wonder how much of that really just goes straight to the Zoroastrian root of religion to begin with. The idea that Zoroaster was the first person to hypostulate the good and evil, the didactic between before that, there was just the other,
right.
You know, we didn't have good and evil, heaven, hell, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's fascinating to think about. And also, once again, the necessity of that, you know, right. Is it the fact that we as humans need that kind of, because even looking at my son, and I will admit it, folks, I have spanked my son. I have spanked my son twice in his life.
Yeah.
And it has been exactly three small pops. He was young. Yeah. It was a couple, two isolated incidents, a couple years apart, but never anything crazy, anything like that. Never right. anything to the point of him fearing me in that kind of way. You know, like I right. definitely feared spankings as a kid because I got them like regularly, oh, yeah. regularly, to the point that my single mom was like, "Where's the pink slip for yep. disciplinary action at school?" So if you're going right. to waste their time, I'll let them spank you. Then I'll spank you. Then I'll tell your dad and he'll spank you on his weekend.
Oh, yeah.
We'll make yep. sure you learn not to do that. But I didn't take that with my son. And it's interesting right. to hear him sometimes still tell his mom things and be like, please don't tell dad. Please. He'll be so mad. And it's like, I'm not mad about it. What are you talking about? Like, I am rarely right. mad about anything, dude. but to him. Mm-hmm. There is this godlike power of approval that yes. I have as his father, mm-hmm. you know, and even on occasion, he'll come to me and tell me something where he knows I'm typically more understanding than mom and be like, please don't tell mom. I just wanted no. to be honest with you, but please don't tell mom,
right,
you know,
right.
And it's interesting to see that because there is that preternatural part of us.
Yeah.
That despite any religion, despite mm-hmm. any law of the land, knows when you have done bad.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, there's just there's an energy to it. It just feels so, I mean, it's so distinct. And we all, I mean, I know within myself, the want to be good, the want to be loved, the want for that connection, to be praised and told that you've done a good job. I mean, when you are simply told, okay, so this kind of goes into, I hope I don't butcher the name, Dr. Masaru Emoto. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Masaru Emoto?
Yes. So he did the water experiments and it was that if you speak or think towards this water molecule versus, you know, a positive thought and then a negative thought, it completely changes the way that it looks. And he, you know, yeah, these pictures, and it showed when you have positive words versus negative words. And so there's this energy too, negative and positive, and we can feel that. And here you can actually see it without us, you know, outside of us. And to me, I mean, that proves so much. And it really speaks to what we're discussing in regards to Santa and being good and being bad, or fearing these other monsters, you know, like there was even, I can't say the name. I always thought it was Joel Boken, but I think that that's incorrect. It's the Yule Cat, and he would come and eat you if you had, if you didn't wear new clothes, or you didn't have a pair of clothes as a child, like a good clean pair. So then you have cleanliness alongside goodness. So, I mean, I think that there's definitely something to that.
Jolocatour.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. And yeah, the idea of, once again, marrying that cleanliness to it. And having that idea of that cleanliness is next to godliness.
Yes.
You know, that you've got to keep yourself not just spiritually pure, but physically pure at the same time.
Well, those water molecules, if you look at them, the good ones look clean and the negative ones look rather dirty.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the interesting thing about the doctor's experiment. Now, I'll pop those up on here, folks, so that you can see them. If you look on the left, you can see these are words that basically what he did was take pictures of water droplets while they were freezing. And as they were freezing, somebody would have a word, not to say or anything like that, but there would be a word over that water droplet to think about with intent. Some of the words were good. Some of the words were like hate, fear, stuff like that. And all of the negative, this was all done with distilled water so that there no impurities in the water to make the crystals malform or anything like that. And the fascinating thing, here are those pictures again, folks. If you look at the ones on the left, they're malformed. They do not look like healthy hexagonal snow crystals, snowflakes, things like that. They look very, very strange and globular. And when you look at the ones on the right that look much more like typical snowflakes, that kind of stuff, those are the ones that have actual good thoughts like love and happiness and fulfillment, things like that. So, yeah, it really did. That was one of the first things that really went out there as far as what does our intent actively do to the world around us? You know, how does it change that? And once again, that idea of gratitude, that idea of giving back, that idea of doing for and unto others for no other reason than to do it. Not even to go with it in the biblical sense of do the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. No, just do unto others what's right, period.
Yeah.
You know, with no expectation of return, the same way that you give a gift. If you give a gift unconditionally, then it is just a gift with no expectation of a gift in return. It's not a gift with condition.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
And go ahead.
It's so hard. It's so hard. I had a blog post today that I wrote about the human condition, and, there's so many layers to the way that we perceive good and bad. There's so many layers to why we do or why we're motivated to do certain things. And some people will feel that, oh, I'm going to do this thing and it's a good thing, and I'm going to feel good about it. But at the same time, you're doing it so you can have praise, so you can feel good about yourself. And is that pure? You know?
Well, that's technically in today's society called virtue signaling. The idea that you are doing something, and you see it a lot on social media. It's right near the rage bait section. It's only a few scrolls away, folks. But quite literally, you'll see it all the time where somebody posts something only to look for that aggrandizement in that kind of way. It's sad, but at the same time, it's kind of like what we've had you on talking about before, and that is that desperate want of confirmation.
Right.
You know, and marry that with confirmation bias, even when you're talking about this. And you end up with something different. You know, you end up with, virtue signaling, things like that, where people are doing things not out of true. And granted, they know that they're good things. But they aren't doing it with the purest of intent, because the purest of intent is just to go feed somebody. You don't have to post, like, have somebody take a picture of you working the bread line and then post about how awesome it was to work the bread line today. It's not like you're at the bread line every Saturday helping out.
Right.
You know, that kind of stuff. And it's interesting, but at the same time, it's interesting psychologically to think about. I mean, it's not actually interesting to read. But it's interesting to think about how we process that and how we process that need and how we bring that need about in our life, you know, and that's kind of the whole idea that ends the holiday season as far as Christmas and things like that go, which is New Year. The idea of being able to begin the new year with a new slate that, you know, kind of like a Lenten promise. This is something I always used to tell the kids that I taught whenever they'd be like, oh, well, you know, I gave up soda for Lent. And be like, you know, you're supposed to keep doing that past 40 days, right?
Right.
Just putting that out there. Like you're supposed to find something to better yourself for the rest of your life and better the way that you interact with the world around you. And don't get me wrong, like giving up soda for 40 days ain't easy. Feel free to try it, folks. I just got off sweet tea. That wasn't easy. All right.
Congratulations.
When you have been parked next to me at many events, so you know I ravenously drink sweet tea. Now it's just regular tea, but
nice.
But at least I've given up the sugar. But that's the thing, is that we're supposed to give something of ourselves for other people in that right. You know, that we're supposed to try to better ourselves so that we're better humans for the rest of the world around us, not just for ourselves and for our own aggrandizement, you know.
Right.
And that's something that rings through so many holidays, through so many traditions, and especially through so many Christmas holiday traditions around the world.
Right. No, it's true. And I mean, it's whether you're celebrating Yule or celebrating Christmas, it's such a beautiful, reflective time. I mean, just wintertime in general as well. And I wish that more people could see, you know, it's not about how barren the trees are or how freezing cold it may be, or, you know, it's this beautiful reflection of what we should be doing on the inside, which is letting go and having that clean slate and starting new. I mean, there's a poem by Giuseppe Ungaretti called Soldati. It's an Italian poem, and it says, it's very simple. It says, the leaves on the trees, so too shall we be. It's something like that. You know, it reminds me of this other on a gravestone, it said, "The way that I am now, soon too shall you be." And it's so true. It's fleeting. Life is so fleeting. And if we could look at these times, these holidays, you know, if you look at how many years you have left, right? Let's say you've got, you know, 50 years left. That seems like a long time, right? But that means you only have 50 Christmases, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we could think of that, that would be, you know, incredible.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I love that video that you put up, by the way. So I actually, just a quick comment. I'm a blogger for Mysterious Adventure Tours. So I write all their blogs, and they just went and did a Krampus run. And nice. I saw some of the videos on there. Oh my gosh. One of our people were standing there and she was talking, and then one of those guys came up and they like pulled her hat down over her face, and another gal got whipped by one of their, you know, one of those things that they're holding with the twigs and stuff.
Yeah, one of their branches.
And I heard a story too from somebody, this was a long time ago, that was on a podcast, and he grew up with this and he was terrified as a child.
Oh, I mean,
imagine, like, we just had the stories, but imagine actually seeing that in the streets.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's just it. The idea of that, the idea of, that being a regular thought for, and once again, ours is in the West and in America specifically, Christmas has a different way about it.
Yeah.
You know, even the concept of Boxing Day in Europe and the UK, where you, not only is it a tradition that you box up your leftovers and take it and give it to somebody less fortunate, that kind of stuff, but there's also the idea of the position swap, where servants would swap positions with the household leaders and things like that, and you swap positions with your boss at work and things like this, so that you learn what it is to live in somebody else's shoes, you know.
Beautiful.
It's a great concept. We don't have those things here.
No.
We don't. It's literally just Santa, and that's it. Yeah. There's the idea of better be good, for goodness sake. He knows it's very, I would say it's very overlordy, because it's the same person that knows whether you're naughty or nice. Once again, like, Saint Nick didn't need to know whether you were naughty or nice. He had Krampus. He had Black Peter. He had other accoutrements.
There was a scarecrow too. I forget his name, but he was also really terrifying, and he would, you know, he acted the same way. But I mean, here again, when you look at Krampus, or I mean, Christmas here in the US, it's all about the commercialization. It's about the money that can be made. And then what that does as well, though, is it perpetuates, like, oh, I'm going to be good to get this reward only, and then I'm going to go back to acting like a tyrant. And so I have definitely seen, I've seen that during the Christmas season, and just, I mean, even in adults, like, I have been treated a certain way. And I mean, even in the dating world, you'll have people that will try to just get together because it's the holiday season and they want to go do holiday stuff. And then they dump you when the holidays are over.
Yeah. I just needed a +1 for 3 weeks.
Right.
and the Christmas scarecrow, centers on Hans Trapp, a fearsome legend from Alsace-Lorraine, France, Germany, about a cruel knight who made a dark pact, became a cannibalistic boogeyman disguised in straw, and now punishes naughty children alongside Saint Nicholas.
Yep.
You know, there's that.
Everything wants to eat children.
and you know, that just that idea, there it is. Right there.
Yep.
Once again, that idea that something is going to come for you if you are not good. And once again, it's not Santa. Yep. Santa's like, this thing has free rein on you before Santa gets there. So Santa in actual tradition is not about the judgment side of things. He just comes right. and rewards you. He just, hey, if you're there, he's bringing you something because somebody else came and took you if yeah. you weren't good.
Yep, exactly. You know, exactly.
There was no need to leave a lump of coal or anything like that.
Yep. Nope, that's exactly true. Which, fun fact, I thought it was the most hilarious thing. You know, now that we live up here in upstate New York and we have an oil heater, there's an older coal stove that doesn't work anymore, and they actually still have a bucket of coal. And so nice. I was laughing and I was talking to the kids. I was like, man, I could put real coal in your stocking this year.
Right, right. And, yep. and you know, that was, I saw a very interesting video breakdown the other day of once again, another holiday tradition, the Christmas mm-hmm. Carol. And, oh. and the whole idea behind the moral of the Christmas Carol, you know, traditionally the moral of the Christmas Carol is don't be stingy, you know, give people a ton of, give people what you can give them. But it was very interesting to see this breakdown of it and a reversal of the curmudgeon-y side of Ebenezer Scrooge and showing him basically as somebody who is empathetically trying to show like, look, I'm doing the yeah. exact same thing I'm asking you to do.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it was fascinating to see that turn of it where it's like, no, he's not saying don't use coal because it costs money. He's saying don't use coal because there's people out there that don't have coal right now. Why should right. we be in here working? We're inside at least.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, I'm asking you to work on Christmas. I'm going to be working on Christmas too.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we all be working on Christmas if we're able to? You know, so it was really fascinating to see that turn of, and you know, still he learns something, what have you, but the idea mm-hmm. that no, he isn't crotchety and stingy. He's just trying to express the fact that like, look, this is something that we should all be doing. Like if we were all like this, then, you know, the person who's out here on the street who's hungry wouldn't be hungry.
Right.
If they were able to save their money and save every single penny and account for it, you know, in that kind of way. And it's interesting to see that. Now, granted, I don't think that that's necessarily a truism because, well, everybody has different lives and things work differently for everybody.
Yes.
But it's a fascinating twist on that traditional story that's there and a different way to look at it where. No, he's actively taking some accountability for himself in the way that he is.
Right. No, and it's fascinating because, I mean, that's the first time I've heard of that idea. And, you know, it makes you think about so many things about how we look at other people, their yeah. experiences, and even our own experiences. And it's so important to be able to keep the open mind and to be able to see things from multiple views instead of just, you know, gatekeeping a staunch belief system and shutting those doors. I mean, yeah. if we were all able to do that, imagine how the world would be.
Well, it absolutely true. Absolutely true. And the example I give typically, Anne, is a gem, a faceted mm-hmm. rock, mineral, what have you. Each one of those facets is unique. Mm-hmm. And especially a cut gem. You look yeah. at an uncut gem, it is absolutely unspectacular.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a rock.
If you look at an uncut diamond, it looks no different than a dirty piece of quartz. You know, that is just not like an utterly clear piece of quartz that's perfect mm-hmm. and things like that. There are imperfections. It's the cutting and the honing of the stone that make it shine in that kind of way. And its natural state, no diamond is beguilingly beautiful like what's in a stone setting.
Right.
It takes the cutting and the polishing of each facet and the careful care of each facet to make it reflect and shine in such a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have, so, you know, I have a lot of spheres.
Mm.
And, you know, these things were just, I mean, my dad had sent me a bunch of different pieces, and some of them were uncut, and they're embedded, and, or, you know, like those, the thunder eggs, they don't look like anything on the outside at all. And then you cut it open.
Yeah.
And then it's something like, you know, it's beautiful. I mean, and each one has such a different, you know, and so it's true. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. You know, we are all individuals. We're all faceted in that kind of way. We've all been cut and honed through the processes of our life, through the stresses that we've gone through. And even the idea of making that diamond, it all comes from the same lump of coal.
Yeah.
It's just pressure and time that make the diamond out of something that is fairly common. You know, it's carbon. It's next to hydrogen, one of the most abundant elements in the universe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an utterly common thing that when put through proper treatment becomes something remarkable and incredible. And that I think is a lot of the distillation of these stories, of these holiday traditions, is to get to that point of understanding that every Christmas we're supposed to be better. Every Christmas we're supposed to be better for our family and be more present with our family and understand that and want that more.
Exactly. No, I agree. And if we could, I mean, it would be beautiful no matter what you're celebrating, though, whether it's Hanukkah, whether it's Yule, whether it's Christmas, all of it should inspire everybody to come together, and it should be about love.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. And that's just it. The Chris Hanukwanzadon is the term that I use.
I love it.
Because it kind of covers all of them.
Sounds like an ancient dinosaur.
Once again, it's one of those. It's fascinating how this time of year, every major religion has something going on, and the focus of it is to focus inward and make yourself a better person. And it's fascinating to me that we need these traditions, that these traditions have been around for thousands of years, some of them, when you start getting into the Icelandic traditions and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, they've been around at least since Christianity hit Iceland. Right. You know, because I would venture a guess that, well, I don't know. Let's get into that real quick in the last few minutes. Was Father Christmas there outside of the concept of Christianity? I know Gaia was and things like that, but
I thought that I read somewhere that Odin was kind of there first, and he had, was it Sleipnir? He had like that six-legged, eight-legged reindeer, and that's kind of where they kind of got, because if you look at Odin and his beard and everything, and then his steed that he rode on, then you look at Santa, there's a lot of similarities. And actually, this was something that I had talked to my children about, because as they got older and they learned about Santa, we kind of transitioned into looking into Odin and into Yule. And so it was more so not about what is true and what is false, but this ebb and flow and this transformation of different things, but having that, you know, that message is still the same.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the idea that, and I was just had Sleipnir up on screen. It was a eight-legged horse of Odin's that allowed him to travel across the nine realms.
Right.
So even the idea of Santa's reindeer taking you from his mythical North Pole where he can't be found to the rest of of the world.
Yeah.
And the idea of being able to do that with fleet of foot in one night, things like that. So yeah. Yeah. It really does marry a lot of things together. And once again, even whenever you look at the Christmas tradition and the idea of Christmas being and Jesus's birthday being this time of year, really the star was much more around my birthday in like, you know, late August, September, something like that. It just happened to be that the cult of Mithra, which was highly popularized in Rome at the time of early Christianity, existed and had temples, and it once again got usurped, and looky there, you have a virgin birth, so do we.
Right.
Cool. Right. December sounds great.
Well, and I think it's important though, and because when you look at it, like what I said earlier, the whole world is kind of, well, I guess not the whole world because Australia is in a different season, but
sure.
The whole thing is, at least here, the whole world slows down. You're not planting and doing all these things that you're doing in the spring and in the summer, and you're preparing and everything.
Yeah.
We need a time that we really slow down. But then the thing is when we slow down and we turn inward, we can get bored. We can get restless. And so you enter into the holidays, and now you have this beautiful marriage of, you know, as within, so without, because outside of you, you have the world that's saying it's time to slow down. And then the holidays are also calling you to slow down. I mean, they should be, but with the commercialization and everything, it doesn't. It's kind of made it more chaotic, but the roots of it, at least.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, you know, even that idea, once again, going, looping this back, the idea of the yin and yang, the positive, negative, good, bad. When you have that time to slow down, you have the time to, in a Dostoevsky way, self-reflect and maybe see what a horrible human being you are. you know? maybe there are a bunch of bodies piled up in my closet. You know,
time to go clear those out.
Maybe the landlord's going to find out and they need to be a body. You know, these are the things that happen. And even the idea of, once again, that moving us, because one of the useless holidays that I love is Groundhog Day. It was a very special day at our university. We always there was always like a huge kegger out in the woods.
Oh, wow.
All kinds of things. It was all campus came out. It was amazing. So for those of us from UD, University of Dallas, Groundhog Day is very special. There was nothing more special to me than the couple times that I went to Punxsutawney
for
Groundhog Day. And just being Cajun and understanding a lot of the root of Mardi Gras, not the boobies and beads, folks, because that's not the root of Mardi Gras. The root of Mardi Gras is coming together as a community to get through the doldrums of winter, to lampoon the rich and make a community gumbo where it doesn't matter, rich or poor, we're all eating. Everybody is going to contribute meat to this, and everybody's going to get a meal in the middle of winter. And we're all going to be no more, since we got to get rid of the meat in the house anyway, it doesn't matter how much of anything anybody brings. Doesn't matter if you bring none and I bring eight, I got to get rid of the eight anyway, because it's Lent. So let's all get together and have one last Yahoo.
That's awesome.
And the beauty behind that as a culture, the beauty behind that as a poor people in medieval France, things like that in the 1500s, and the way it gets usurped and changed into what it culturally is now. And to see that same thing kind of reflected in Groundhog's Day, where the prognostication of Phil the Groundhog means absolutely nothing.
Right.
Zero. He sees his shadow, you have 6 more weeks of winter. If he doesn't see his shadow, you have 6 weeks till spring.
Yep.
So either way, you have 6 weeks of winter left. The idea, it's useless. What it is the surmounting experience of everybody coming together. The whole town of Punxsutawney is open all night the night before. Wow. You can go get a 6-pack of beer and say, I'm going to take this out and go to the other bar. And they open them all up and go, you have fun, buddy. and you just bar hop and you go out and you eat and you hang out and you go to these ridiculously themed parties with people with sashes on and top hats. And he's I'm the mayor for the day and like all kinds of things. Like, and this line of groundhogs that has existed for in perpetuity. Since they started it, you know, and it's fascinating. And it's all for nothing but community.
Yeah.
It's literally the fact of you were in the middle of doldrums of winter. You've been going through it. You got just a little bit more to go. Let's all get together and get over the hill. You know, and it's interesting to see that in the ways that we come together like that. And we could, Christmas is very much, once again, that coming together like that for, yes, religious reasons. Okay. The Christmas as we know it, as we celebrate it, is rooted in religion. And that understanding that we've got to have the bad with the good. We as humanity have to be able to reflect on the bad with the good. We have to see that reflection in the mirror. And without that reflection in the mirror, it's hard for us to get that perspective.
Yeah. Nope. You're exactly right. And that's hard. It can be really hard for a lot of people to face themselves and to really come to terms with those things. But, you know, there's such a magic during this time of year and these holidays. So what a better time to do it, you know? But then again, I understand too that it can also be a harder time because maybe you're going through this and it's the holiday season and the people that you would have spent it with are no longer with you. So that it also, it's, there's such a duality to it because it's beautiful, but it can also be deeply sorrowful at the same time.
Absolutely. It is I posted an image last year, you know, the typical meme image that you see of Leonardo DiCaprio toasting.
Oh yeah.
And it was like, here's to the crippling holiday depression. With a message of like, seriously, folks, like, as somebody who suffers from depression, the quote that I remember most ever is Robin Williams, depression hides behind a smile.
Yes.
And the idea of you will rarely know those that are like, you may see some melancholia, stuff like that. But believe me, folks, those that are out there that are having the problems that we're talking about, they're right next to you. They're working in the cubicle next to you. You're having lunch with them. You're texting with them right now.
Oh yeah. They're on the podcasts that you watch.
And they're everywhere. And it's important to think about that this time of year because it's important to, my wife said it today, because we've been having all kinds of issues with slow season and stuff like that coming out of it. But even just having the retrospective point of view of think about the problems we had this time of year 7 years ago.
Oh, right.
And the fact that we ain't having those problems anymore.
Yeah.
Personally, financially, all those things. 10 years ago, where were we? You know?
I was just on the phone with somebody today who asked me to do that very same thing. Look at where you were back in 2015.
That's right.
Look at where you are right now.
That's right. That's right. And once again, polishing that facet of perspective, you get another view of that beautiful glistening gem that you are. And the fact that, it took time and pressure to make that diamond and somebody had to saw a part of it off. But without all that happening, there would be no shine.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
So, these are things that we have to think about during the holiday season because it's not just about presents. It's not just about,
the lights,
you know,
and decorations.
Those things are beautiful. They're amazing, but it's about gaining that perspective. It's about gaining that life perspective and what we can do to be a better cog in the machine of the universe, to be a better atom in the molecule. However you need to look at it, one more berry on the mistletoe doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
You know? So I want to thank you, Anne, for taking the time to come on, for always taking the time to come on, just for being a friend.
It's such an honor. I love
kind of
being
stuff.
Here.
But I love our conversations because they really are, your conversations are something that are genuine of heart and that is, a great perspective to have. So thank you so much for all you do.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
No, same, same. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to follow Entomology because you're, of course, out there on platforms. You have your own website. Where can they go to keep up with the latest and greatest? Where can they go? Because your book is being re-released.
It is.
All kinds of things. So
it is.
Shameless self-promotion time, Anne. Go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Well, okay. So first and foremost, I have my website, which is annceline.com. And I'm also very active over on Facebook. So you can find me on Facebook under annceline. And then Instagram is kind of getting going a little bit more. I'm learning how to, you know, play with that more. And I love it. So that's Entomology. And gosh. And then, of course, I have my Medium. And I believe that Medium is also at Entomology.
Yes.
So yeah, definitely. I would definitely suggest to follow Medium first and foremost. That's where my heart lies. And then if you want to contact me, do it over on Facebook. And then for fun, Instagram.
Absolutely. Well, Anne, thank you so much as always for your time. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for the show. All kinds of stuff. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from Anne Celine and Entomology over at annceline.com. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can find the videos page with not only all of the declassified government panels, everything else that are going on with UFO UAP, but also all the video channels of our guests and friends of Curious Realm. That's also where you can get your link to CuriousResearch.org, where you can buy your field observation and encounter log, as well as your remote viewing session journal. If you have a friend or family member that is into paranormal investigation or remote viewing, that is a great holiday gift to check out for them. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time. As always, it is your open hearts, your open minds that make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.